good morning, ladies, and happy Valentine's Day. I see that some of you are wearing red. I forgot that it was Valentine's Day. My daughter reminded me. She's getting married in 2.5 weeks, so she thinks it's a big deal. And we've been married almost 25 years, or 24 years. And so we're going to celebrate on Friday because that's easier. And our big thing is we go to dinner. That's like the length of Valentine's Day for us. But anyway, moving on. I thought today it would be fun to give you a little bit of a history lesson, since the book of Isaiah is kind of, it's got a lot of stuff like Nell and Bebo. I'm like, I have no idea, is that a music group or what's going on? So it's kind of helpful to get a little bit of an idea of the background. And so I wanted to go back just a little bit. In the book of Genesis, don't worry, you don't have to turn there, we have a promise that was given to a man named Abraham, where God said, I am going to bless you and you're going to be father of all of these nations. And so from Genesis chapter 12 through 17 is all the story of God's promise to Abraham. He tries to do it on his own with his wife, figuring it out, and God says, no, it's my way. And so then they have the son, and the son that they have is named Isaac. And so Abraham has Isaac, and then Isaac has two sons. One of them is named Jacob. In Genesis chapter 25, we learn about Jacob. And Jacob's name, I love looking at names because God talks about his name, and that has to do with his character and his reputation. So when we look at the attributes of God or what God calls himself, we're looking at the name of God. And so when he gave someone a name, it meant something big, instead of like, oh, that's a cute name. So Jacob means heel catcher. And the reason why that was interesting is because Jacob was a twin. And the first twin came out, and his name was Esau. And when he came out, Jacob was holding his heel. And so they named him Jacob, which means heel catcher. His name also means supplanter, which of course I had to look up. I don't know what that means. And that means in the place of. And what's interesting about that is In Old Testament, in Israel, well, this isn't Israel yet. In Old Testament times, the firstborn would be blessed above all of the others. And so Esau was the one who was supposed to get the blessing. But Jacob was able to steal the blessing. He and his mom conspired, and they were able to get the blessing. And so his name means heel catcher or supplanter. Well, he was going to be named something else. And so in Genesis chapter 32, after he gets the blessing from Esau, he takes off because Esau's like, I'm going to kill him, which is like what big brothers do, right? And so he takes off, and he's gone for years and years and years. And then when he's on his way to come back, he has this weird night. In Genesis chapter 32, we read that he wrestles with this man all night long. Well, the man, at the end of the night, when the sun's coming up, who's wrestling with him, says, I want to stop now. And he's like, no, we can't stop until you bless me. This is not really something that I've ever experienced, so it seems kind of weird to me, but this is how it happened. And the man says to him, your name was Jacob, but now your name will be Israel. So he named him Israel, and from him all he had 12 sons, and those are the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel. And he named that place Peniel because he said it means I have seen the face of God. So he knew that he had somehow been wrestling with God all night long. And God touched his hip. He limped the rest of his life so he'd never forget it. And he named him Israel. And Israel has two meanings, which I thought was really interesting. The first one is Prince of God. And that's so cool because Israel became the chosen people of God and the line of God through which the Messiah, Jesus Christ, would come. Israel also means wrestles with God. And what I find interesting about that is the nation of Israel has wrestled with God ever since. They have gone through this whole experience where they have totally rebelled against God. They'll go through, we have the book of Judges, which is like one big cycle. They're following God, They get caught up with these people. I'll go this way because that's the way you see. They're following God. They get caught up with these people that are against God and are involved with other gods, fake gods. They decide, oh, this sounds like fun. I'm going to follow these gods. God says, I'm not good with that. They get thrown into some kind of captivity. Then they cry out to God for help. And then God sends a judge to come and help overcome this, and so then they're like, okay, praise you, God, I'm going to serve you, and then it starts all over again where they start getting caught up, and this is the wrestling that has gone on ever since he named him Israel. So years later, about 700 BC, along comes this guy named Isaiah, who we're looking at. His name means the salvation of Yahweh. Yahweh is the personal name of God. So he writes this book because he's a prophet of God, and he's a major prophet, which means he just had a lot to say. He wrote a lot. He wrote 66 chapters, chapters 1 through 39. So as we study the different chapters, and they're not in order, take a look and see where they fall, because in chapters 1 through 39, he's speaking to them about captivity with the Assyrians. The Assyrians were a people who hated God, had nothing to do with God. They followed their own gods, but God used them to judge Israel for the fact that they were continuing to rebel against him. Then in chapter 40, which we're going to start with today, chapter 40 through 66 becomes a prophecy where Isaiah starts speaking about this Babylonian captivity. Now, he didn't know this, but it wasn't going to happen for 100 years. So what he's speaking from Isaiah chapter 40 all the way through 66 is all stuff that he's seeing visions, and he doesn't know what they mean exactly. And it all happens 100 years later, even to the fact that he names the king that's going to be involved in all of this, King Cyrus. And King Cyrus wasn't even born yet. And so it was amazing that he was able to do that. So through all of this, we have lots of judgment that comes. You're going to hear a lot about idolatry and things like that, because that's what they were doing. They were getting into idolatry. And you're going to hear a lot about this judgment. You're going to hear a lot about a prophecy about the Messiah, that Jesus Christ would be coming. The book of Isaiah has more prophecy about Jesus than any other prophet of all of the prophets of the Old Testament. But the chosen people of God, the people from the line of the Prince of God, were completely rebelling against God. And Isaiah starts speaking about it right away. In Isaiah chapter 1, starting in verse 2, and I won't ask you to turn there, but he says this: Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. That's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Anytime you see all caps for the word Lord, that's Yahweh. That is the personal name of God. The Lord has spoken. Children have I reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. Why will you be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? He's crying out, guys, what in the world are you thinking? The Holy One of Israel is your God. But he was not judging them. God was not judging them in order to condemn them. And that's the hope of this book. He was judging in order to rescue them. In that same chapter, chapter 1, as we start out the whole book of Isaiah, he says, starting in verse 18, come now, let us reason together. Though your sins are like scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be eaten by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. For any of you who walk around thinking, oh, God is, he just loves us. And you know, he just would never do anything to make us feel bad. He is the Lord. He is in charge. He is sovereign and he has all power. But anything that he ever does of what you have to walk through of hard consequences is never to condemn you. It is always to rescue you from the destruction you're bringing on yourself. And through all of the book of Isaiah, you're going to see prophecy about the Messiah so that there could be hope to know that this suffering they were going through in the Assyrian captivity and the suffering that was going to come in the Babylonian captivity, that it was all temporary. And we had hope in a Messiah where he speaks so clearly in Isaiah 53 through the whole chapter, but I'm just going to pull out two verses, verses 4 and 5. He says, "Surely he has borne our grief," speaking of Jesus, "and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed." In Isaiah 42, it talks about him, and it says, "A bruised reed he will not break." He will not snuff out a smoldering wick, because that's not what God is all about. He's about hope. He's about, yes, you may be bruised, but he's not going to break you. He's going to make you stronger, and he's going to draw you to him. This is the hope we have. So why is it important for us to understand the attributes of God? Why study this? Because you won't serve someone you don't know and trust. If you believe that God is somebody that he's not, if you believe that he's angry and that he wants to condemn you, why would you go to him? It's important to know who he really is, because once you know who he is, you will be able to come and be with him, and you won't rebel against him, and you won't wrestle with him. Without understanding who he is, you won't recognize your own rebellion. You'll think that everything you're doing is fine until you see yourself in light of who he is, and then you will be amazed by his mercy. Because when I see myself in light of who God is, how big he is, how good he is, the fact that he doesn't condemn me, I'm overwhelmed by the fact that I cannot possibly measure up. And yet, that's not how he looks. He's not looking to me to see if I'll measure up. He's just loving me and drawing me to him, just like he is with you. Without understanding who he is, you won't have hope. In the midst of your trials, you will wrestle with God. And that is not what he wants. So today, we're going to go to Isaiah 40, which is the beginning of the prophecy of the Babylonian captivity. And I just love that God, this is who God is. He warns us when something is going to be coming. When we've been walking in sin, he will warn us, this isn't going to go well for you. You might want to get out of it. And we don't always listen. And so the question is, you willing to listen? Because it'll save you a lot of pain. So it begins, chapter 40, with offering the comfort of God and recognizing his power. Isaiah is saying, okay, guys, what you're about to face is going to be hard, but know that God is still on his throne. He is all powerful. Turn to him. So the first point we're going to look at is check out your God. He's our mighty, victorious, gentle shepherd, and no one is greater. Check out your God. Verse 9 starts this. He's speaking to Isaiah. "Go up on a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news." Notice it's good news that he has. "I'm about to send you into Babylonian captivity. Good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up. Fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God." And if you've been around Harvest at all, you've heard that the word behold means check it out. Check out your God. "Behold, the Lord your God comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom," which means close to his heart, "and gently lead those that are with young." I love the contrast between verse 10 and verse 11. Verse 10, he is strong and powerful. He brings his reward with him to the battle because he knows he has the victory. In the Old Testament times, when there was a battle, when it was done, the person in charge, the king or whoever, would bring this reward with him to all the people who had fought in battle. And he would bring the reward and say, "You've done great." Well, this is saying God doesn't wait for the battle to be over because he already knows he's won. He brings his reward with him because he knows he has the victory. And then verse 11 talks about him as a gentle shepherd. He is a gentle shepherd who gathers lambs, remember we're sheep, close and carries them close to his heart and gently leads those that are with young. The same arm of verse 10 that rules is the arm in verse 11 that gathers and carries close to his heart. He is all powerful, all loving. He is all good. Verse 12 goes on, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span and closed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance?" What does this mean? God is so much bigger than anything we can imagine. Look, imagine it, looking over a sea. If you've ever been to a beach or at Lake Michigan or something, and you look out, and you know this is just one body of water, and you can't see the end of it. It says he measures that in the hollow of his hand, that God holds it. We can't even comprehend how big that is. And then he says, look at the dust of the earth, or the vast mountains and hills. Think about how the fact that people die climbing up mountains because they've got to get to the top. And I've been at the top, Pikes Peak in Colorado. You can't breathe. I don't know how they do it. It says got oxygen. I had a shirt or pants that said got oxygen because you get up at the top and you're so high up there that you can barely breathe. People die trying to make it to the top of these mountains, and God says, nothing. I made that, spoke it, and there it is. People are overwhelmed looking into the Grand Canyon when you see that vast, and there's so many more canyons than just the Grand Canyon. And God said, yep, my work. I can just, you know, look right at it, and it's done it. It says he weighs them, and they're nothing to him. He marks off the heavens. That word for marks off is also measure, and it means he fine-tunes it. God fine-tunes the heavens. They're nothing to him in comparison to who he is. Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel? That word measured is that same word for marked off in the original language. Who has fine-tuned the Spirit? Who shows him his counsel? Well, I can tell you, I've done it often, but he usually says that I don't know what I'm talking about. But I've tried, and it doesn't work. So if you haven't tried counseling the Lord and what he should do, I'd say don't bother. It doesn't work. Verse 14, whom did he consult and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Answer, no one. Say it with me. No one. I'm going to say these verses again, and after each question, I'm going to ask you to say, no one. And think about it. Do you believe it? Who did he consult? No one. Who made him understand? No one. Who taught him the path of justice? No one. Do you believe that? Because if you do, say it like you mean it. Who taught him knowledge? Yeah, you and I didn't. Who showed him the way of understanding? Yeah, we try. It doesn't work. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are counted as the dust on the scales. Behold, check it out. He takes up the coastlands like fine dust. All the sand that you've ever been to, I grew up on the west coast of Florida with all the beautiful white sand. Nothing for him. He takes it up like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. The nations are a drop from a bucket. Have you ever been like so thirsty, like you felt like, I'm just gonna die if I don't get something to drink right now? And then you go to a glass, this happens to me almost every day. You go to a glass and there's nothing in it but one teeny tiny little drop. Try to let that be what satiates your thirst. Does it? Does it quench your thirst? No way. He says the nations are like a drop from a bucket. They have no power. They do nothing. They quench nothing. This is all dust on the scales. They're dust on the scales. You take a scale, a little bit of dust on it, it doesn't even measure on the scale. You go, it's gone. The nations, the rulers, you just blow the dust off the scale. They are no match for God. We look at all the rulers. You look over the history of mankind and all the different rulers that we've had. You look at the fact that we had a president that just had to step down because he timed out. It had been 8 years. He's no longer a ruler. God is still ruler. God is still on his throne. And with the president we have now, and no matter what your thoughts are about it, God is greater. He's on his throne. It doesn't matter. And then it says, see the trees of Lebanon. We have a picture of a tree of Lebanon. There you go. Now, the trees of Lebanon were like, they're all over. And look at the size. Now, that's a big guy standing there. And the size of the tree, and it says that it doesn't suffice for fuel. It's saying, not enough for God. You cut down that tree, and that probably gives you enough fuel for a year? Really, really long time, at least. All the trees, nothing for God. None of them make any difference. They're not enough because God is so much greater. We cannot measure up to him. So this is actually a relief. Your salvation is not based on works because you cannot possibly do enough to measure up. It's all dust. It means nothing. It's God who comes to you. Verse 17, all the nations are as nothing before him. They are counted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. It is not that we are nothing to God. Otherwise, Jesus would never have had to come. He would have never chosen to come if we meant nothing to him. But it's that compared to his greatness, our greatness is nothing. Look at that tree and that man next to a tree. The tree overpowers the man, and God spoke that into existence. He's so much greater. And the question is, do we see it? Do we see how much greater God is? Now, I brought this out. This is my little illustration for you. Plus, if I get sad, I can just hold it, but I'm doing okay today. I have a dog, and his name is Toby, and you'll understand this in a second because right now it's like gear shift. But, you know, women are like spaghetti, so I'm sure you're all with me. So this is representative of my dog, Toby. But Toby's black and much more licky. He licks a lot, gives lots of kisses. But one thing that Toby loves is he loves to come and sit in my lap, and he loves for me to pet him. Now, the problem is, a lot of times, I'm holding him like this, and I'm petting him. He's only 15 pounds. But if I'm holding like this and petting him, he can't see my hand. And so, he starts pawing me. Pet me, Mom. Pet me, Mom. And I'm like, I am petting you, honey. It's behind your head. Nope, can't see it. Pet me. So then I have to change the way I'm holding him and come and pet him so he can see my hand. And if he can see my hand, he's fine. And I can keep petting him. And I just wonder, how much are we like that? God's power is there. It is always there. But if we can't see every aspect of it right in front of our face, we paw because we don't believe that his power is there. Can we say, God, will you help me to trust you, to trust that you are who you say you are? And when you say that you measure the water, do you see when you go to the beach, do you see a big hand holding water? No, you don't see a big hand, but that doesn't mean his power isn't real. He spoke it into existence. He is above all rulers, all authority, all the heavens, all the earth. There is nothing that is greater than him. So when we open our eyes, and we will see, he is the mighty, victorious, gentle God that he claims to be. And as point two goes on to say, God is greater than any idol or any ruler. So humble yourself before him and worship him alone. Chrissy talked about idols last week, and we're going to be talking about it again this week, and I would be not surprised if as time goes on, it's going to come up again, because that is what causes us to rebel against God. But it says that he's greater. So he goes on in verse 18, he says, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness compare with him? An idol. He says it with an exclamation point. An idol. Seriously? An idol. A craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and casts for it silver chains. Who is like God? No one. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, God is speaking, and he says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Who is God like? No one. He cannot be compared to anyone. And he is certainly not an idol. Verse 20 goes on, he who is too impoverished for an offering chooses wood that will not rot. He seeks out a skillful craftsman to set up an idol that will not move. It's immovable. It doesn't do any good. And so I find it very interesting where it said that you can't fine-tune the Spirit. We can't measure the Spirit or tune him, so we try to create idols that we can fine-tune. But an idol will not move while God holds the waters in the palm of his hand. Why would we choose something that we can control rather than the God of the universe who is in control? We need to ask ourselves that. What is motivating for me to choose something I can control rather than bowing to the one who is in control? He goes on in verse 21, do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth when he blows on them. And they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. God's power is intimidating, and it's hard. It says he sits above the circle of the earth. You think about how big earth is. We can't even comprehend how big it is. He sits above the circle of the earth. And just as an interesting little side note, I find it very interesting that to this day, people talk about science as being, well, if it's not true in science, then it's not true. And science takes precedent over the scripture. Well, let me tell you, science is changing all the time. And in science, they said that the earth was flat. But if they had just looked in the Bible, it says, he sits above the circle of the earth. I bet there were scientists sitting around during that time when they read this, and they were like, oh, that Bible, they're so dumb, they don't even know that the earth is flat. How am I supposed to believe anything about God if it's going to tell me that the earth is round when the earth is flat? He sits above the circle of the earth. There is nothing that God says that isn't true. He stretches out the heavens. He spreads them like a tent. He brings princes and rulers to nothing. He takes away power. He is in charge. No matter what it looks like, he is in charge. So why is it easier to choose an idol rather than the Lord? Having an idol is short-sighted. But when I choose the idol, I get to make the idol, right? So I get to decide what I'm going to follow. But here's the thing. When I think I'm in charge and I'm following this idol, as Christy said last week, my idol can't hear. My idol can't answer me. My idol can't save. And I have to keep it going. I have to keep the idol moving because it's not going to move apart from me. And it's what I get in the short term. It may be something I want. It may be something I fear. But I go after that, and it has no lasting satisfaction. So then they had a piece of wood. Well, I don't have a piece of wood, so I'm good, right? So how do I know if something is an idol? Well, in biblical counseling, and you heard Christy say this again last week, it says we define idols as anything or anyone that begins to capture our hearts and minds and affections more than God. An idol is any person, any object, any motivation that begins to capture our hearts and minds and affections more than God. They would choose a piece of wood for the same reason we choose our idols, because the idol makes us think that it'll give us what we want, or it answers a deep fear that we have, but it never delivers. We are always worshiping something 24 hours a day. You are worshiping something or someone right now. The question is, what is it or who is it? So how do you know what you're worshiping? I'm going to give you a few things to think about. You worship what's on your mind. When you're just sitting and you don't have a bunch of things going on and your mind is allowed to wander, what does it wander to? You worship what's on your mind. You worship what you long for or wish for, what you have your heart set on, what's really important to you. And for whoever you worship or whatever idol you have, you will sacrifice for it. Think about, what do you sacrifice for? Spend time or money on it, talk about it, serve it, protect it or defend it, build your schedule around it, perfect it, get angry if someone or something blocks you from it. You will experience intense fear or anxiety if it's threatened in any way. And you can even spiral into despair or depression if you fail to get it. So what are some questions I can ask myself? Three questions you can ask yourself to be sure if something is an idol. And I'll tell you, sometimes it hits close to home. Am I willing to sin to get it? Am I willing to sin if I think I'm going to lose it? Or do I run to it for refuge instead of turning to God? Am I willing to sin to get it? Am I willing to sin if I think I'm going to lose it? Or do I run to it for refuge instead of turning to God? I don't know if this still goes on today, because technology has come a long way, but there was a time where in Africa, when they wanted to capture monkeys in the jungle, they would put a cage out. The monkey didn't see the cage. They would make a hole in that, which all they had to do is put a banana on the other side. And the hole was big enough for the monkey to get his hand through. But once they grabbed onto the banana, they couldn't get the hole back through. And they would just sit there and try. They couldn't get the banana through the hole, so they would just sit there and hold on to it until somebody came along and got them and took them away. And all they had to do if they wanted to escape their captors is let go of the banana, pull their hand out, and leave. But they caught them this way all the time. So if the banana is our idol, what happens when we hold on so tight to it that we're not willing to let it go? And I'll tell you, it's hard because you have these fears of what it's going to be to let it go. So what do I do? How do I let this idol go if I need to? If I have one, I need to. That's kind of the obvious. So I have four steps that I want to give you for being able to let go, or if you recognize that you have an idol. The first step is admit it. Admit that you have it. A lot of times we try to ignore it, we try to rationalize it away or justify it, and so we have this idol and I don't have it. I need this. And the hard part is too, it's not a piece of wood. It's not something where you've set it on a place in your house where, I mean, it could be, I suppose, but most likely you're not bowing before something every day. But there's something that you have as an affection that is deeper than your affection for Jesus, that you're willing to sin to have instead of running to him. And so the first thing you need to do is admit it. Because when you're unwilling to admit it, you will never face it. Don't try to ignore it, justify it, or hide it. And the second thing to do, and the admitting it is to yourself, the second thing is to confess it to the Lord. Confess to the Lord. Lord, I've been clinging to this banana. And I just, by the way, I love bananas. I've been clinging to something that looks good, feels good, or shows me off. I've been clinging, and I want to let it go, but I don't know how. And the hard part is, a lot of these idols are things that you can't completely get rid of. Like, if your idol is food, you can't stop eating. And so how do you, or if your idol is, which, believe it or not, even when you're in a rough marriage, your idol can become your spouse, because you're so caught up into that person that you're not caught up into seeking the Lord. Even if it's, well, my spouse won't lead the way he's supposed to. Your spouse, you can't get rid of your spouse. You're not supposed to. Okay, let's just say that right now. Keep your spouse. Okay, you can't get rid of your spouse, but he can be an idol. Or money. Well, you have to pay bills. You can't just go stop working and just say, well, you know, God will just provide. God has provided. Gave you a job or gave your husband a job. Success. You still need to work hard, but as to the Lord. So these idols are so intertwined with things that we can't give up. So what do? We admit it that we have a problem. We confess it to the Lord, and we surrender it to Him. We surrender it to the Lord, and Lord, I still have to eat, so will you show me how to eat in a way that honors you? As it says in 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Whatever I'm doing, will you show me how? Surrender it to Him. I want to let go of this banana. And know that it's your job to hand it to Him, but it is not your job to change your heart. You will keep picking it back up, and you have to keep surrendering it. It is God's job to change your heart. So, Lord, with your help, I will not try to take this back, but only with your help. And God's going, yeah, I know. You need my help. That's why I'm here. Especially when you have to give up the heart behind the idol. The idol is not necessarily the issue. The issue is your heart. And God wants to change your heart. So those are the first three things. The fourth thing, I believe, is the absolute most important. They are all necessary. But this one, if you don't get this one, you're going to be right back there. And that is focus. Focus your attention on the Lord and not on your idol. So what happens is, I say, okay, Lord, I have this idol. We'll use my little polar bear. I have this idol, and Lord, I want to hand this idol to you. I admit that this is an idol to me. Not really, that's not my problem, but I do have others. I admit that this is a problem to me. I confess to you, Lord. I'm not going to try to hide it. I confess it. I surrender it to you, Lord. And now, where do I put my focus? Lord, this idol, it's just so wrong that I have this idol, and I'm so going against you, Father, and I shouldn't be going against you. And do you see that you're still having the idol when your focus is still on the idol? Does this make sense? I need to stop focusing my attention. I need to focus my attention on the Lord. See the Lord for His greatness, His love, His power, His sovereignty, all of His attributes. And then as I worship Him and focus my attention on Him, my eyes are no longer on this idol, and I'm able to let it go. And all of a sudden I realize that wasn't really that big of a deal. I made a much bigger deal out of it than what it needed to be. Praise you, Lord. Because He's the one who helps us get rid of those idols. So admit that you have a problem. Don't try to hide it or ignore it. Confess it to the Lord. Surrender it to the Lord. Confession and surrender are not the same thing. Confession without surrender is, I give myself permission to be this way. Surrender means, Lord, I'm handing it to you. And then focus your attention on the Lord and let Him be the one who takes it. When you focus your attention on the idol, even though you're saying it's bad and you don't want it, you will get stuck in shame and you will still hide from God. When you focus your attention on the Lord, you will worship because you will see how He helps you release and the freedom you have as you give it up. So humble yourself before him and worship him. And lastly, our eternal God sees you, and he never gets tired of loving you. Wait for him. Please write on your notes, as soon as you get done filling in the blanks, please write this on your notes. God sees me, all of me, and he loves me. God sees me, all of me, and he loves me. Your idols do not love you. Your idols will not save you. Your idols demand a price for you to have them. But Jesus paid the price for you, a price that you couldn't pay. Verse 25 goes on, "To whom then will you compare me that I should be like him?" says the Holy One. Who will you say I'm equal to? How will you measure me? Superman has kryptonite. I'm greater than Superman. Iron Man had a suit that would get destroyed and come off. God is clothed in majesty, and his majesty is who he is. The Hulk was fueled by anger. God is fueled by love. Who are you going to measure him to? He calls himself the Holy One. What does it mean that God is holy? It means that he is, John Piper has this great definition. It's a long definition, so I don't expect you to write it down, but I'm going to go over it, so don't worry. God's holiness is his infinite value as the absolutely unique, morally perfect, permanent person that he is and who by grace made himself accessible. God's holiness is his infinite value as the absolutely unique, morally perfect, permanent person that he is and who by grace made himself accessible. His holiness means that he is infinitely valuable. Psalm 145 verse 3 says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable." Infinitely valuable, absolutely unique. There is no one like him. No one. We cannot create God in our image. He is his own image. Jeremiah 10:6 says, "There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might." He is morally perfect. 1 John 1:5 says, "There is no darkness in him at all." There is no darkness in him at all. He is permanent. As we'll see as we look ahead to verse 28, he is the everlasting God. No one will take his throne. And he has made himself accessible. Ephesians 3:12 says that we can approach him with freedom and confidence. And Hebrews chapter 4, verses 15 and 16 says we can boldly approach his throne to receive grace and mercy. He is accessible. He is here for us. He sees you, all of you, and he loves you. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. Lift up your eyes high and see. If you want to see God, look. All you have to do is look. You won't see if you're not willing to look. So why not look? What stops us from looking at God? Is it that if we look at God, we will have to humble ourselves and recognize that he's in charge? And isn't it worth it to do that? He is creator. He knows all and sees all. He is strong in power. Verse 27 goes on, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God?" Keep in mind, again, this is a prophetic writing about the Babylonian captivity that was about to come. So he was saying, you're going to say, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God. Why do you say this? God was letting them know that I am not condemning you in this captivity. I want you to experience life apart from me so that you'll stop running from me. And he says, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel? Same person. Jacob, Israel. Jacob, heel catcher. Israel, wrestles with God. Same person. Jacob was his physical name. Israel is his spiritual name. God loves not just your spiritual life, he loves all of you. Your physical, whatever you're going, you don't have to compartmentalize God into this is my part of God and now this is the rest of my life. All of God sees all of you and loves you. So this is the struggle we have though, right? We say, God, you've disregarded me. God, you don't see me. My way is hidden from you. And this is the struggle we have. I'm not coming.